Hello, and welcome to another episode of Dr. Crime. Today's episode is going to be a little bit different than usual, because rather than focusing on one case, I'm going to educate you on one of my favorite topics.
Are we finally doing a white-collar episode?
Rebecca, it's the white-collar episode. I'm so excited. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Dr. Crime, a true crime podcast hosted by me, Justice, a doctor of forensic psychology.
And me, Rebecca, a criminologist.
You won't find clickbait titles, selfie thumbnails, or spooky music to set the mood here. But what you will find is ethical true crime with extra focus on empathy, accuracy, and a viewpoint from professionals.
So grab your coffee and let's get started.
Now, before you turn this off and say, I don't care about rich white men who don't pay taxes, I am here to tell you I have some short stories and examples of white collar crime, not only because I think it's really fascinating what some people do for money, but also I think it's really important to teach these things.
I really think that with white collar, you should start from the beginning and explain what it is, because I don't even really think many people, including myself, even understand what white collar means.
Yeah, so white collar crime is defined by the FBI as financially motivated, nonviolent, or directly nonviolent crime committed by individuals, businesses, and government professionals. So it can range from tax evasion to extortion. There is a whole wide variety of crimes that can occur. And honestly, I'm a firm believer that if there's one white collar crime, that means there's at least two others involved. It's never just one bad thing. And that leaves a web of drama and a web of mess in all of the cases.
We actually have a running joke where if Justice is in a bad mood, all you have to do is whisper embezzlement or... Yeah. Ponzi scheme, and her face just lights up.
It really does. Ask my husband, because he kind of has the same joke. So anyway, in order to explain what some white collar crimes are, I want to give examples in cases. And since I know white collar is not necessarily your thing, what is something you've always wanted to understand?
All of it. But no, really, let's start with money laundering. I think it's one of the more interesting ones, mostly because it's one of the only ones I know about, but I feel like people use the term really liberally and maybe not always the right way. Like, my entire knowledge of money laundering is basically the show Good Girls.
Yes, which Good Girls is a good example of money laundering. So money laundering is one of my favorites.
They're all your favorite.
Okay, well, shots fired, but yes, fair enough. Anyway... So, money laundering is the act of getting money illegally, but you're putting it through a legal front.
I'm gonna need an example there.
Fair. So, here's a little case sample for you. The Wachovia Bank is one of the largest schemes of money laundering. So, what was happening was drug cartels would set up fake accounts with the bank, with Wachovia Bank, and they were, it was under like a fake business almost. So the drug cartels would go in, create a bank for some, you know, nonprofit, and they deposit all the money. And then whenever they wanted to take the money out, it was just whatever. Now, it doesn't really sound like that's necessarily the bank's involvement, except the bank knew about this and they purposely weren't putting. There's a suspicious activity report that banks are supposed to put out, and they were actively neglecting these accounts by the drug cartels, and they had laundered over $378 billion through this bank.
Jeez. Okay, so it's like literally washing money. You're not telling the government where it comes from, so you have like a front where the money comes from to make it look legit.
Correct. And when money comes from a legal crime, the feds will know, right? Because how do you all of a sudden have $20,000 in your bank account? Like, you have to trace that. But what they'll do is when you're money laundering, you'll have business fronts. The three most common places are laundromats, car dealerships, and bars, because you can go in and say, I'm going to buy this $10,000 car, and you hand them $20,000, and that extra $10,000 is now becoming quote-unquote laundered when they're doing their taxes. Oh, well, they paid me extra. We negotiated. They paid me extra. So now that dirty money is now going through the front of a legal business and is now, like, counted on by the government. Did that make sense?
Yeah, and kind of shockingly, like, Good Girls was pretty accurate in their portrayal of money laundering.
Oh, yeah, they were. It was pretty. I've only seen a couple episodes, but I follow a lot of like white collar people on TikTok that do say that like it's pretty close.
So something that I will never truly understand, I don't think. Well, I'm sure I will because, you know, I know you're gonna explain it. But what the fuck is a Ponzi scheme?
A Ponzi scheme. Okay. So it's essentially a fake business that you get others to invest in.
Why would you invest in a fake company? I'm not following you here.
Okay, fair enough. So I'm sure, you know, when I said white collar, the first people think of is this tycoon, Bernie Madoff. So he was an investor on Wall Street, right? And what he would do is he would tell someone, oh, I have this brand new company. You're going to love it. It's going to make, you know, millions. And of course, they talk in stocks and like financial terms that none of you are going to care about. So, but he'll essentially be like, oh, this is going to have great investment return. You know, we're going to double the profit. This is going to be the CEO. He's an up and coming person. Like, you're going to love it. And so, because when you have a good reputation, right, and you get a good reputation by having successful companies, people don't question you. Like, all right. If Bernie thinks that this is a good investment, I'm going to throw him $1 million towards this investment. And that's chump change when you're talking about investment. So now what happens is that company that Bernie was just selling you, it doesn't actually exist. So you just handed him $1 million with nothing in return except fake papers, you know, fraudulent SEC regulated stock exchange and papers that make it look super legit. So his investors would throw money at him. And as he's creating more of these accounts, he's getting a lot of money. And then when people are like, remember that investment you told me about? I haven't really seen too much return on it. I'd like to cash out. Or he'll take investments from other people and give it to those people, say, oh, this is the quarterly earnings for this company. They're doing great. Here you go. And that's how Bernie made a massive profit. None of the companies that he got people to invest in were real. And he was just pocketing the change.
So they're writing him checks for, like you said, $1 million. He's just pocketing that instead of putting it towards the company because that company didn't even exist. And then when someone wanted their money back, he would just pay them out by using other fake company money.
Yep. So it's one giant circle, essentially. So he would have thousands of people that he would convince for all these different companies, and he would make some of them look super legit and have good returns so that people didn't catch on. So even if the next person he got $2 million from, he might hand off that $2 million to the first investor and be like, you made $1 million. Here you go. Because then you're not looking suspicious.
Like robbing Peter to pay Paul.
That's exactly what it's like. And one of my favorite parts about the Bernie case is he was almost caught in 1999, but he had such a great reputation that the person that had reported the suspicious activity was completely dismissed and considered paranoid.
Aw, leave it to politics. That just sounds so on-brand.
Right?
But, okay, hold up. So, if a Ponzi scheme is creating a fake service and the person at the top is getting all the money and scamming people out of their money, isn't that the same thing as a pyramid scheme?
Close, but not really. A lot of people do mix them up, but here's the difference. A Ponzi scheme has a top dog that creates all the fake companies. So yes, while all their lower dogs are paying their higher dogs and then they're getting a profit, with a pyramid scheme, there's an actual product and an actual sale. But with a pyramid scheme, every time you recruit someone, you take some of their money for the product they sell. So you start with one person at the top, that person will recruit three people and then will get a portion of their earnings. So now the person at the top gets three extra earnings from all those people. And as they get their downline, right, that means that those people will then recruit someone else. Now the person at the top is making even more money because they're still taking profit off of the original three people that they recruited. And then it all just funnels to the guy at the top.
Did you happened to watch the LuLaRoe documentary that just came out kind of recently.
Rebecca, come on. What am I, an amateur? Of course I did. I figured
you had. That's my level of expertise with pyramid schemes. But I think that we all know someone that's fallen for one. Mm-hmm. Like, it's crazy how they're technically illegal, but there's all these loopholes. I've seen some of those lawsuits, and, like, it's nuts. I don't understand how people keep falling for it.
I have no idea. On Reddit, we call them the Hun bots because it all, like, whenever they go to recruit, you're like, hey, Hun, haven't talked to you in 14 years since I bullied you mercilessly in high school.
It's always someone from high school who was not nice to you.
100% of the time. But I think what drives us all, and I mean, it comes down to the marketing of the company, because if someone told me that they just work from their phone, make their own schedule, make thousands of dollars a week, wins all these trips to all these, like, idyllic places. Mm-hmm. You couldn't sign me up fast enough, right?
Right.
But what people don't realize is that that comes with, like, I think when I saw the statistics, less than 2% of people involved in these types of products actually get to, like, live in a comfortable income. Because, first of all, you have to start off with buying the product, right? And it's normally like $500 to $1,000 worth of product.
Jeez.
Then you have to sell that product, and you don't get any commission off of selling that product. You only get commission if you tell other people, you know, come join. And once you sign them up is when you start making commission. So it's not as easy as, oh, I'm just going to, like, I know so many of those people that are like, I have my own company, and they sell, you know, Herbalife.
And they call nope. themselves, like, entrepreneurs.
Yep, you're not an entrepreneur. I am so sorry, but you are not. Right. So some people believe that the product itself is a scam. I know Avon is technically a pyramid scheme. Avon's, like, the only products that I've ever, liked. But again, Herbalife, and I keep bringing them up because I'm going to talk about them in literally 1 second, but, you know, your LuLaRoe's, your Beach
Isn't
Body
Sensi
Workout.
A pyramid scheme?
Yep, Sensi's a pyramid scheme.
You know
a
what? I will ride and die for Sensi, though. My house smells good as fuck.
Right. You know what? Sometimes it's okay.
It just didn't. I know you just mentioned Herbalife. Didn't they have to pay out, like, over $100 million or something?
Yeah, minimum. Herbalife has seen just about every lawsuit under the sun. And I mean everything. Claims from the SEC of a pyramid scheme to investigation of conspiring with foreign entities.
What?
Mm-hmm. So between 2007 and 2016, Herbalife knowingly and willfully conspired with others in a scheme to falsify its books and records to provide corrupt payments and benefits to Chinese government officials. And that's according to the Department of Justice. I took that straight from the Department of Justice website.
Jeez.
Even the Herbalife director has embezzlement charges. Like, when I say that this company is oof, I mean it's the biggest oof.
They're still, like, in production, too, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. It just cycles through people.
Oh, my God. Speaking of embezzlement, let's talk about that for a minute, because, man, some people have nothing but the audacity.
I know. I need to know where they get their audacity on sale, because, girly, listen, I do not currently work in my field, and I work for accounts receivable, which is also a fancy term for collections. For a major utility company, right? And I actually have a special project where I work with town municipal accounts, and I can't tell you how many times I get on the phone with someone after like months and months, and I'm like, hey, you're behind so much money right now. And they're like, yep, our previous guy's currently sitting in federal prison for embezzlement, so give us a couple months. And I'm like, oh.
I was gonna say, knowing you, you're probably like, tell me more.
That's one time, and I kind of knew this person because I talked with her like a couple times through email over like other accounts that she was responsible for, and I was like, girly pop, you gotta tell me more, because you can't just leave me hanging like that. But embezzlement is always, I know people, like I said, get so bored with this, but I find it so creative on what people will do or how stupid people get with their greediness and just keep doing it and keep getting caught.
I remember that you talked about a case where some lady embezzled like $50 million.
Oh, Rita Cronwell. That's oh, what a story. What a story. And by what a story, I mean greedy. Listen, okay. Rita Cronwell was a town treasurer in Dixon, Illinois, which is like a super small town, what you think of like a small town America, right? Mm-hmm. So from 1983 to 2012, she would get money from the town to pay off accounts or taxes or whatever you're supposed to do as the town accountant. And instead of putting said money into the state account or paying off what they're supposed to, her fingers must have accidentally slipped and put it all into her own bank account.
Oh, I hate when that happens.
It happens all the time. So what she would also do is, because this is, again, a very small town, Illinois, she went to the bank and made different accounts, like city sewage and water accounts, so that when there is a consistent income and outgo, no one questioned it, right? Because you have people that work at the bank that know you.
Right.
So that way, no one would detect it, right? No one would question it. She even convinced the town at a town meeting that the budget was so tight they need to rein back on their spending, they need to increase taxes, they need to get rid of, like, they need to lay off people because the budget is just not okay. But the town was doing just fine. Like, when they go back and look at all the books, the town was actually doing really well. People in the town weren't getting raises, they weren't getting repairs needed, they weren't fixing the roads because they just didn't have the money.
Why wouldn't she just, like, stop when things were good? Like, when she got however much she needed.
Yeah. Well, she bought a house, a horse farm, not a house farm. She did buy a house, actually, but she bought a breeding horse farm. She bought luxurious new cars. She bought, like, a new house and a vacation home and, like, everything under the sun. And people were always wondering, like, oh, how does she do it? And they just thought that her husband had made good money. Like, they didn't think that it was real.
No one was suspicious of the town auditor just randomly buying a horse farm.
Well, she convinced the town that they couldn't afford an auditor and basically did the good old...
She was the treasurer, right?
Yeah, she was the treasurer. And when they went to have an auditor, she basically did the whole Linus, you know, just trust me, bro, logic. We're like, we don't need one. I'm doing just fine. Yeah.
I mean, someone must have at least suspected something.
Well, whenever it was questioned why money was going missing, right, because people weren't getting raises, things weren't getting fixed, bills were going late, she'd be like, oh, there were late fees, or a new contract started, so it's more expensive, or, oh, we didn't make enough this month, so I had to really scrape by, we really need to up taxes so we can, like, fix this.
Okay, so for almost 30 years, this woman's just taking the town's money, making horse farms, luxury cars. How did she eventually get caught?
So she went on a vacation.
Oh, let me guess, on that taxpayer dime.
Yeah, she absolutely did. I bet she was a best damn vacation, too. But it was a longer vacation. I think it was like 2 or 3 weeks. But it was long enough that they had to have someone as a backup to make a couple payments. And that person went to make payments and saw just how far behind they were in everything. And this was noticed on like the second or third day of her vacation. So like the 2 or 3 weeks she was out, the town conducted like almost a full-on investigation, and like the banks were willing to just hand over things without warrants, and like they were all, because everyone, like, I don't want to say everyone knew something wasn't right, but everyone was like getting frustrated that why was the town's money doing so poorly? And that's how it unraveled.
You know, it's stories like that that make me understand your love of white-collar crime, because how stupid and like greedy do you have to be?
Exactly. Like, a large majority of white collar crime is smart people who get away with things.
Mm-hmm.
But then they get greedy, and greediness breeds stupidity, right? Like this one case. And this one case I'm about to talk about was actually going to be like the original, like, script for this episode, because it's going to blow my mind. You'll understand in a second. But I don't want to say favorite case because this offender is live and well and probably would like the notoriety that some little girl from New Hampshire, like, finds him interesting. So I'm not going to say that. But in White Collar, there is the con man. Mm-hmm. You know, we all know the Frank Abagnale story from Catch Me If You Can. And we know the cons of Mother Teresa and Sylvia Brown and all them.
Isn't there a conspiracy that Abagnale didn't actually do any of it? He just, like, took all the credit?
There is. I'm not sure what to believe, to be completely honest, because it would be brilliant if he did those things, and it would be brilliant if he didn't and said he did. Right. So, I don't know how I feel about that case, but yes, there are theories that he didn't actually do all of that. Hmm. But I'm not here to talk about Abagnale, who people think is, like, the greatest con man. No, no. I'm here to talk about someone named James Sabatino.
Italian name.
Yeah. And what really gets me is, like, as you go through this story, you're going to picture this guy as, like, the most charming white guy with, like, those eyes that dagger through you and a smile that could, like, nope. Complete opposite. Aww. Like, and I'm not judging on anybody's looks. I'm just saying, when you think of a con man, you think of the guy from the show White Collar, right? You think of Matt Bomer. You think of a Derek Shepherd. You think of, like, dark, tall, handsome, I can get away with anything. No. I kind of want you to look up a picture while I'm telling the story so you can laugh. So listen to this. Jimmy started his cons off young, right? He was, like, a prepubescent child, and he would lie about things to garner money and, like, donations from people. He was lying about who his parents were, if they were alive. He would start fundraisers for, like, things that were happening in his own family, things that weren't happening. Like, he started young. And at the age of 16, he would call around LA and Miami tech stores, like Radio Shack type places, and say he was the nephew of Tommy Mottola, and Mottola was the top exec for Sony Music at the time, and he needed equipment for a music video, or needed it for set, or product placement, whatever. And so he was like, hey, mail this to me, I'll give you advertisement, product placements, whatever. And they did it.
Okay.
So he did this for over 6 years, where he's literally reaching out just to random places and being like, oh, I need this $7,000 piece of equipment for a music video. And because he had, like, the first couple years went without a hitch, they just, oh, it's Tommy Mottola's nephew. Here you go, homie. Like, so he did this for 6 years. He also reached out to FedEx saying that he was an exec for the NFL and that a package was being mailed to the wrong address and that they needed to stop the package. Sabatino convinced, like, the reps, supervisor, like, he went super high up, that the address was wrong, and they firmly told him that if the address is wrong, he would have to pick it up. Well, he obviously couldn't do that because you need an ID. So he continued to say, like, he continued on with the story. He was traveling, and that's why it's going to the wrong address, and it needs to be done. So after a while, they sent him this package that had over 239 Super Bowl tickets.
Jesus. Also, I'm interjecting in your story because I just pulled up his picture.
Right.
I don't want to make fun of the way someone looks, but I will 100% say that's not what I was expecting.
It's not what, especially for some, like, even just in hearing these of, like, I'm Tommy Mottola's nephew. I'm, like, you right. would not expect what you're looking at, right? You'd expect some form of charm.
In, like, the nicest way possible, he looks like a bad con man.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I'm not even breaking the surface on the things that he's done yet.
Oh, God.
So Sabatino's running around Miami like a freaking king, right? And he decided what his next con was and was setting the steps up, like, five steps ahead. So he needed some notoriety first. And what he would do is he would mail top hotel chains. He would mail, like, Disney and Hilton and, like, I almost said the Tipton, but that's not a
that's
real hotel.
Not real.
but you get the gist. And he said that he was a big fan of the hotel and wanted a comp night. He knew damn well he wasn't going to get that. But what he did get was official letterhead. So Sabatino would scan the letter, steal the letterhead, and write a letter stating that he was to stay in the president's suite or whatever their like top suite was for free as a VIP. So he would show up and present this letter on official letterhead, and they'd be like, oh, here you go. He did this to over 5 hotel chains, over 60 hotels and fine dining all up and down the Eastern Seaboard. Now, because he was using these suites, he would bring up people to his room for parties. Like, what would you do with all that space? So he was just partying with people left and right. And of course, appearance is everything. Like, he would, people would believe whatever lie he told them about whatever his profession was, because like, how would you get that if you were just some con man from the streets, right?
Right. Man, it almost reminds me of Anna Sorokin a little bit.
Very similar. Yep.
Did Jimmy get arrested for any of this?
Yes. He wasn't initially caught for his hotel scam. He did get arrested for talking with an underage girl and partying with her. Okay. I did read some reports that he got nude photos on a cell phone, but this was back, I think, in like literally late 90s, early 2000s, where like it wasn't necessarily considered child pornography at that point.
It wasn't, like, taken as seriously as
it wasn't now. Taken as seriously as it is now. So he only got a few months because it looked like he had sexual interest in the teenage girl. But he did later go on say that, like, he didn't necessarily know she was underage. She was just there for the party and she was drinking and he thought she was hot. Like, whatever. And I don't mean whatever as in, like, you should brush that off. Like, it's traumatizing for the girl. But.
Yeah.
So. That was his first bust. But it wasn't a long sentence. He did get caught later on for the hotel thing, but it was never for more than like a couple months at a time. So not only was Homeboy straight up conning everyone, and I mean everybody, including like police, he actually started to get involved with inner circles of celebrities. And he was from Miami. So
oh, wait. Everything makes sense now. He's a Florida man.
He is the Florida man.
The Florida man.
So because he was from Miami, he would meet all kinds of people. Well, he would tell people he worked closely with Diddy, Busta Rhymes, the Notorious B.I.G., and that he was their producer or he worked with Sony Records because, again, that was like kind of his shtick all along, which, of course, was just another con. But with that con, he would get a lot of local rappers. And again, he's still getting hotel rooms somehow. Don't ask me how he did it. But he's in these hotel rooms and he's like, oh, well, I'm a manager. Like, I'm gullible at times. I'd probably believe it. Like, oh, you know. So he would get the recording stuff using the con as Tommy Mottola's nephew and then have all these local rappers that wanted to be like Diddy and Notorious B.I.G. And he would do the recording. Well, it kind of came out that nothing ever came from it. Mm. Now, again, he was caught for most of his crimes, which is kind of funny because, like, for as smart and, like, kind of creative as these schemes are, he was fucking stupid.
That's how the cookie crumbles.
And he was in and out of prison. He was actually in prison. He went to prison in England for something. He traveled to England. I don't know what he got caught for, but he hated the prison so much that he wrote a threatening letter to the White House in order to get extradited to America.
That is not something you hear every day.
No.
Yeah.
But also, like, creative.
He has a lot of ideas. I'll give him
he
that.
Has. It's an idea where you kind of cock your head and be like, that's not.
That's not the worst thing I've ever heard.
It's not the worst thing I've ever heard, but it definitely took some brain cells to put together, even though it took all of them back. Now, you're probably thinking, she's done with the story, right?
Well, I know you, so no.
I'm not. Because he was still on his shit while he was in prison, he would still do things like scam Nexel out of over $1 million.
From prison?
In $1 million while he was in prison.
Oh my god.
He had an outside man that would do the dirty work. So what would he would do is he would call his friend, and his friend would three-way in whatever Nexel place he was doing. And he did the whole, oh, I'm working on a music video, I'm a producer for Diddy and Holmes and like whatever. I don't know why I said Holmes, but producer for Diddy, whatever. But I'm out of town for the next couple of days. I'm going to have my associate pick it up. This is his name. And they would pick up the merch and then just sell it on the street. And then they'd split the profit while he was in federal custody.
Jesus.
And as if that wasn't bad enough, he also forged a letter to the LA Times saying that it was an associate of Diddy that was responsible for the death of Tupac. So you're thinking, no one's going to fall for some random piece of letter saying that it was Diddy, right? Except it wasn't just a regular letter he forged. Oh, no, no, no. He forged it to look like a leak from the Department of Justice. He got the letterhead. He got, and it was later found out pretty quickly because so journalists released the story that the Department of Justice had found that it was Diddy, like an associate of Diddy, whatever, that killed Tupac. But after like a day, of course, the Department of Justice is like, what the fuck is going on? They're like, guys, this was clearly not written by us. It doesn't use any of our acronyms. This is not how we file reports. Like, why would you do this?
Well, I had absolutely no idea that some like dope 90s rap lore was because of a white collar criminal. Genuinely had no clue. This is a surprise to me.
Right? It's fascinating.
It goes way deeper than I thought.
So he also continued to run scams and schemes out of prison, as we were talking about, to the point where he kept getting more time. And he requested to the judge to be in solitary confinement because he believed he was a danger because he was just going to keep doing it. He is now severely restricted from phone calls in prison. And he actually wrote a letter like recently, I think it was January of this year. He wrote a letter to a judge saying that he's the most restricted person in prison. And he's only allowed to call his lawyer. He's not allowed any phone time. He's not allowed any writing stationery. He has to be watched anytime he even makes a phone call. His letters have to be completely and meticulously read by corrections officers if he's going to mail something. Like, he's not even allowed in Gen Pop.
Now, these stories are what get me. Unlike, you know, Martha Stewart in her insider trading or whatever.
Listen, she wasn't trading insider trading, okay?
What?
Mm-hmm. Martha was actually arrested for false statements, obstruction of agency proceeding, and conspiracy.
Please forgive me, white collar god.
I know. You will be forgiven this one time. But yeah, people think she was plotting insider trading, but there is no actual proof. So essentially, she invested in a company called ImClone, which is a pharmaceutical company, and she sold all of her stocks, which, for the record, is not illegal.
Right.
But the day after she sold all of her stocks, a highly anticipated drug that was going to be, like, the drug for the company was blocked by the FDA.
Yeah, I can see where that doesn't look great for her.
Yeah. She wasn't even the only one that sold them. The CEO of the company did, too. And her manager knows the CEO and knows some people on the board. So, because of that link, they all thought that she was an inside trading. However, they investigated her, and she basically said, snitches get stitches, bitch, and didn't say a word.
Okay, one, Martha Stewart's a badass, and I honestly didn't know that. Like, I've really always heard that it was insider trading.
Yeah, most people do because it really looks like insider trading and everyone's like, oh, she did it. Right? There's no doubt. But she got away with it because she didn't say anything and she's like, nope, they had no proof that she talked to her manager the day that she sold it. So they had nothing against her.
Okay, I have another question. Something else I probably don't fully understand. What the fuck happened with Wells Fargo? Like, I know they got into some shit, but, like, I never really understood what was going on.
So, Wells Fargo is a great example of corporation crime. So, back in the 2008 crash, Wells Fargo was the only bank to have a profit during that time. The only bank out of the millions across America. Everyone wondered how they did it because obviously we were in a crash, right?
So how did they do it?
So what they would do is they encouraged employees to create fake bank accounts from existing customers. So if you had a checking account with them, they would duplicate your info, create a savings account, and when inevitable fees hit, it would charge the original account. They could do that by going into your account and resetting the PIN. And after that PIN was reset, not only did employees have full access to everything, employees were encouraged to go wild with opening lines of credit, applying for mortgages, etc. And because the employees had full access to everything, they would change the contact information for the new accounts that were made. So you didn't even know what was going on. And of course, with all these accounts opening lines of credit and stuff like that, they were making massive fucking profit. Then when the credit wasn't being taken care of, the extra fees would then be charged to the original account under hidden fees. So fee upon fee was building, and extra line of credits were creating such a large profit.
What happened to the employees that are just recklessly spending money that they don't have?
Well, the good thing is that they did fire over 5,300 employees, and new legislation was put in place because of this scandal. If I recall, I do remember some high-level management getting jail time, but when I went to double-check like all the numbers, I couldn't find anything official. But I do distinctly remember that people were being arrested as well for this, like higher-ups that were like bank managers that were allowing their employees to do this.
Man, you really like fraud, huh? Totally. Just tickles your fancy.
It does. It's so... I love it. I'm kind of, you know, shifting my life path, and I think I actually want to do fraud investigation because it's, like, so interesting and so wonderful. And, you know, speaking of fraud, I also would like to intersect a little something here because I think it's really important to talk about because it's so current. And I want to preface this next segment, if you will, by saying that we are not a political podcast, right?
Nope.
Our views are not expressed, and the information that we give is the aim to educate, right? That being said, it's really important for me to talk about the financial crimes that Trump is being indicted on.
Yes, please. I am so confused as to what's going on with Trump. Like, why was he even arrested in the first place?
Well, there are many sides to this, and let's start with the first one who was indicted. Now, in order to explain this, I kind of have to explain Michael Cohen's role first.
Did you read his book?
Rebecca, come on!
All right, yeah, okay, I know.
So, Michael Cohen was Trump's longtime lawyer, and he was definitely in Trump's weaved web. But what got him in trouble was actually for tax evasion, because he had been putting his money into offshore accounts, particularly the money he received from Trump.
For our listeners and for me, what is an offshore account?
So an offshore account is a bank account held in a foreign country, countries that usually don't have extradition laws as well as low income laws. So what people do, not just Cohen, is they get a large sum of money from someone or whatever, and in this case, Cohen received the cash from Trump, and instead of depositing that into his normal bank account, which would be entitled to regular taxes and claim on tax forms and all that jazz, he would deposit it into the offshore account. That way, it's not claimed anywhere on American land and therefore non-taxable at American rates.
Oh, so when rich people talk about like hiding the money for divorce or murder or whatever, that's what they mean. They're putting it into an account that the government can't see.
Exactly, because offshore, the government doesn't have any reason to go into that, right? So Cohen was taking Trump's from payment and putting it into an offshore account so he wouldn't get taxed on it, which Cohen, in his book, said he believed actually Trump is the one that sold him out on that, because he had told Stormy Daniels, like, so Cohen told Trump, don't say anything when it comes to Stormy Daniels, because Cohen's team got a hold that Stormy Daniels was going to come out and say something. Trump was like, oh, we need to do this, we need to do that. And Cohen was like, no, don't say anything, just let it go, right? But this is Trump, and that's not what happened. So because he was like, I'm going to say something, you're a terrible lawyer, I hate you. And conveniently, Trump was the one that he believes is to file the anonymous report of the tax evasion. But Cohen's book details a lot about how the second he went against Trump, he was fired or he would have punishment or anything. And as a lawyer, he would sometimes have to tell Trump not to say anything. And Trump would do what he wants, and then again, there is backlash.
Okay, yeah, that sounds about right.
Right. So just to kind of get like a little dynamic between Trump and Cohen. So anyway, back to the main story. Stormy's team had reached out saying they wanted to release the story. Cohen said, let it happen. The media will die down. Trump insisted they paid her hush money, which I would like to point out, hush money is not illegal. It's formally essentially called an NDA, a non-disclosure act. You don't say shit, I'll pay you. Everyone's happy. So Trump tells Cohen to make the payment for him. He tells Cohen to write the check in Cohen's name and wire from Cohen's accounts into a bank account under a name that is not correct, and that Trump would pay Cohen back.
Oh my God, what's the worst thing that could happen? That sounds totally legit.
Yeah, sounds legit. Well, Cohen said he couldn't technically do that, but Trump can write Stormy the check and even claim it as an NDA or whatever, and it would be fine. Just put it on the books as an NDA payment, and there's nothing wrong with that. But Trump insisted it would be better if it came from Cohen since he was under so much scrutiny. First, it took Trump forever to pay Cohen back, according to Cohen's book. Then, when there was an investigation into taxes of Cohen, they found that he had paid Stormy in the name of Trump, which is where that becomes illegal.
Wait, so why would it be illegal for Cohen, but if Trump did it, it wouldn't have been?
So think of it as light money laundering, essentially. It's considered financial fraud because Cohen had to write it as legal fees and write it as services that he never received from another lawyer, which is the fraud, right? He didn't actually get those. But if Trump had just said NDA payment and you don't have to put anything else in there, that's fine. But because Cohen had given them money and technically it didn't come from Trump and it went into, you know, this, it was considered wire fraud because it was a fake bank account that Stormy was then taking from, that's where it became illegal.
Well, it also didn't help that instead of just admitting to the NDA and the payments, Trump just said he had nothing to do with it and blamed Cohen.
Yep. So Trump said that Cohen's the one that made all the payments. He has nothing to do with it. It was just good him being a lawyer and doing what he needs to do as a lawyer. But if he had just filed it properly, most of that wouldn't have happened. And I do also want to note here that Cohen also did go to prison for his crimes as well because he used fraudulent accounts to make payment and used billed hours or billable hours for a cover as payments, which is just as illegal.
Now, as we were writing the script, Trump actually got charged with more indictments. So I think it's only fair to explain the charges. We also do want to reiterate again that Trump is innocent until proven guilty. Well, everyone is, but...
Yeah, right. So it was funny because I actually wrote the script and then literally like 3 hours ago, they just released all of the charges. So I had to quickly update everything. So the new indictments, there were 37 new charges against Trump.
Jesus.
Charges 1 through 31 are the willful retention of national defense information. Now, this isn't about what the documents were, but that he was illegally holding the documents regarding national security. These are considered espionage charges. Count 33 was withholding a document or record, which would be an obstruction of justice. Count 34 was corruptly concealing a document or record. Count 35 was concealing a document in federal investigation. Count 36 was a scheme to conceal, and count 37 was false statements and misrepresentation. So it's worth noting that in the indictment, it was noted that Trump suggested to his lawyer to get rid of documents. He suggested to create false documents, stating that there were no more documents at Mar-a-Lago. In Cohen's book too, he said that Trump did this a lot where he would start to get in trouble with the law and he'd be like, get rid of it, do something fake, and that was always against the lawyer's advice. Mm. But it's not just that he had the documents, which is in the indictment. It's that he also had shown civilians and staff some of the documents. And there was a picture of a box labeled top secret with secret documents sprawled all over the floor.
Allegedly.
There's an actual photo of it, too.
Just kidding.
And if Homeland, and like, you have to think too, right? They found all of these documents at Mar-a-Lago, and you have no idea who's coming in and out, right? Mm-hmm. And if the show Homeland taught me absolutely anything, it's that you never trust anyone in the political world. So that, within and of itself, is a whole bag of political and white-collar crime.
Can we go back real quick? You mentioned espionage. We haven't covered that yet. Do you want to talk about it?
Yeah, definitely. So the espionage charges. A lot of people think that espionage automatically means that they were a spy, or that means that, like, the media or opposers of Trump will see espionage and think that he was a spy for a foreign country. But that's not essentially true. So the Espionage Act is essentially when someone who has security clearance with the Department of Defense and they have classified documents that were not correctly reported or obtained by an official. I would also like to note that the definition of espionage is to convey information with the intent to interfere with operation or success of the armed forces of the United States or to promote its enemy's success.
So, but is it really espionage if the papers weren't used for the enemy's success? Like, we don't know what he was allegedly doing.
We don't. But just by having those classified documents in an unsecure location means that any foreign enemy can just see the paper. So while he may not have aided in the enemy, he didn't not aid the enemy by using proper security.
That's like HIPAA. So it wasn't like he took the documents and leaked them to a foreign enemy, but it just like kind of falls under the same umbrella.
Exactly. And that would be treason if he did send those documents to a state enemy. But espionage can be anything from unsecured documents to leaking classified information to a foreign nation. Again, if you've seen the show Homeland, which I just binged and it's incredible, this is what the highest level offensive, like having knowledge of your attacks against the country, your weapon usage, like your plans of attack if something were to happen. And if any of our foreign enemies found that information, that leaves us incredibly vulnerable.
So it's not as bad as it sounds, but it's still not great because the insecurity means anyone could have seen the papers and who knows who saw them and who they reported them to, or I mean anything.
Exactly. And espionage is also considered a white-collar crime. And I feel like we're barely scratching the surface when we have corporate greed and we have
justice. I think we have enough examples for this episode. We're at almost an hour.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. I do just think that the profile and sociological perspective of white collar crime is so fascinating. We didn't even touch on extortion and the crazy stories of healthcare fraud. And we can always do
a part two. What I really want to know is the psychology behind all of this.
I mean, it really depends on what we're talking about. Psychopathy and narcissism are at the top of the chain. But it really just kind of depends on what the crime is and what the motivating factor is.
It's really interesting because, you know, we kind of pointed out, like, it's really most of the time it's about, you know, getting that bag. But it does seem like when you compare white-collar crime to other types of crime, like maybe violent crime, that the offenders they're very intelligent. I wonder if that's because they're less motivated by, like, emotion.
Yeah, that's something I would love to research. I would love to just understand, like, the motivations behind it. We know it's all about getting that bag, but is there, like, an internal desire? Is there a personality desire? Like, oh, what stems it, you know?
You gotta find out for us.
Well, that's it for today's episode. And thanks for sticking around for this long, if you have, and you didn't turn it off because of the boring crime that justice is enthralled with. But Rebecca and I do have some bittersweet news to share with you.
It is with great mixed emotion we have decided it might be time to step away from Dr. Crime.
We absolutely love and adore all of you who have supported us along the way, and we couldn't have done this project without you. we've just both had the realization that while we absolutely love this podcast and all of you, it was just wearing on us a way that we didn't imagine.
We truly want to thank all of you from the bottom of our hearts. Tune in next week for our very last episode of Dr. Crime, but with it will come an exciting announcement.
Because this might be the last of Dr. Crime, but it's not the last of us.
That's right.